Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Okay, the first package in the list today is Kyle, K-I-L-E. I'm assuming that's how you say it, Kyle, Kile. I guess it kind of depends on the pronunciation of those letters in your language. But Kile, I kind of like Kile. Kyle Kile is a LaTeX editor. And you may have heard me in previous episodes. You may not have. But you may have heard me in previous episodes say that I didn't know LaTeX. And that is still true. I don't know LaTeX. But I can safely say that I know more LaTeX now than I did before. Before, I basically knew nothing. I didn't understand the layout, the format of LaTeX. I didn't even know where to begin. Now, probably a year ago now, someone on Mastodon was editing a book. It was a game book, like a rule set for like a tabletop role-playing game. And he did a general call for people to proofread it. So it was a Creative Commons work. So I volunteered and he mentioned that it was written in LaTeX. And I thought, probably not going to be that big of a deal. I can probably muddle my way through. And sure enough, my filter for markup worked perfectly well. And I didn't feel after reading that like I knew any more about LaTeX than I did before. And it's just weird because I read, it must have been 100 pages of LaTeX markup that I read through. And I just, because I had my Word editor hat on and not my markup editor hat, I have no memory, technically, or, you know, no vivid memory of it being in LaTeX. So anyway, now that I've sat down and used Kyle a little bit here and there, I do feel like I know more about LaTeX. I don't have a good picture of the entire workflow still, at least not in the way that I have, for instance, of DocBook or ASCII Doc or something like that. But I can do a couple of things with LaTeX now, and I certainly have come away from the experience feeling a lot better about LaTeX. I feel like LaTeX had sort of a reputation for a while, or I don't mean it, but like for a while in my life, I remember thinking, "Oh, LaTeX, that's that overcomplex, ugly markup language that nobody uses anymore, except the." I thought it was like a science thing, like a couple of people in scientific circles used LaTeX, forced themselves to use LaTeX because it alone had the ability to do fancy mathematical markup. And of course, that's not true, but that was kind of the idea that I had. And I mean, it may well be that LaTeX can do fancy markup for mathematical formula better than other languages, or easier than other languages. I don't know. I mean, I've talked about some other alternatives on this show for markup, for math, but LaTeX does seem to have that reputation. So there is that sort of niche audience, I guess. But honestly, my experience so far, limited as though it may have been, I don't mind it, actually. It's not bad at all. It makes sense. You'll be pleased to know that a really basic Hello World document in LaTeX is really, really easy. Now, obviously, part of this, the ease of this experience is assisted by Slackware itself. Slackware has Kyle installed. It has a LaTeX backend available, like an engine. What is it that it uses, actually? I don't even know off the top of my head. TextLive, TextLive, TextLive. That's what Slackware comes shipped with. But there are other like distributions of text or implementations of LaTeX that you can get as well. T-Text, I think, is one of them. And then certainly in slackbuilds.org, if you do a search in SBO Find for text, T-E-X, you'll get a lot of results. Anyway, TextLive works well enough for this anyway, and Really simple. So that's already installed. That was my point. Sorry. So the text backend stuff is already installed. You don't have to bother with it. And then Kyle is already installed. And so you don't really have to bother that much with it either. And so this, it's just, you can just fall right into text, into LaTeX. It's really, really nice. Okay. So super simple, like four line hello world document with live preview. So open up Kyle. I think it will prompt you probably to choose a file type, or maybe it just drops you into a blank document. I'm not sure. If you close that blank document and then go to file new, then it will prompt you to choose a template, and you can choose whatever you want. I chose article, and then it gives you the skeleton of an article, but that's not the simplest possible article. You can get simpler. So just delete everything in there and then do a / document class. Now, because you're using Kyle, essentially, you know, we could think of it as an IDE almost for LaTeX. It auto completes what you're typing. So document class comes up, and then there's apparently a square bracket with options in it and a curly brace with the style in it. I'm going to skip the options for now. Maybe I'll get to that later. And I'll just go straight to the braces. So I'm going to do an open brace style. No, I'm not. Open brace. It doesn't prompt me for that. That's interesting that it doesn't have auto completion for the arguments. But anyway, you can type article and then close the curly brace. There are other styles. I haven't used them myself. But like DocBook, there are other styles, like sort of like templates for LaTeX. So article is one of them. And then we're going to do a / begin, the word begin, B-E-G-I-N. And then another curly brace. And we're going to type in document. Close the curly brace. And now you're in your document. And you can just type all day long. Hello world. Hello again world. Paragraph, paragraph. Or, you know, return, return. This is my paragraph, my third paragraph even. And this is my third. This is, actually, I'll just do this. This is one sentence per line is how I like to write in general, because then if you make changes, Git can find, you know, a diff program can find those changes really easily and show them to you. If you embed everything into big paragraphs without line breaks, a diff program just looks at the whole paragraph as one line and diffs it very differently. Anyway, this is my third paragraph. Oh yeah, this is a, I think, what would it be? Probably Kate part. Like this is the, you know, the editor that you get in Kyle will be very familiar to you. And the reason for that is because this was made with KDE Framework 5. And so, you know, big robust text editor blocks are all using the same technology on the back end. And it's just so nice, you know? I mean, like, if you're used to Kate or vaguely used to Kwrite, and then you get used to, my mind's gone blank on the what other application uses that right now, but then you use Kyle, and suddenly it all feels, okay, develop, I think is what I was thinking of, but then you use Kyle, I mean, you're using the same editor, but highly tuned and embedded within, you know, towards something, some other purpose. So it's really, really nice. And then once you're finished writing your markup or your text, then you close your document with a / end, END, curly brace, document, close curly brace, and that's it. Now I guess you could save it. I guess I'll save it. And then you go to build if you want, and I'll do a quick build. Now if you go to build and you go to live preview, you should have live preview activated. But as I've just sort of hinted by the fact that I had to go and do a quick build, the live preview is only a mostly live preview. I mean, it does all right, but sometimes it does take a little bit of time to catch up with what you're actually working on. So I very frequently have to go up to live preview, live preview, and then do a quick build, which apparently you can also just do an Alt-1 and it auto-generates it. Oh, you know what? I see one of my problems. No, it still has to, okay. I thought I saw something, but no. Yeah, it's not what I thought. Okay, so anyway, the live preview is only a live preview to a degree, but it's really nice because you do get to see the results of your markup pretty quickly over in the right side of your screen if you want to. I mean, you might not want that, but that is awfully nice. That's really, that's convenient. It kind of alleviates a little bit of doubt, you know, because if you're not sure what you're doing, it can be a little bit disconcerting to just blindly author a document in a strange markup language and then only get to see the results at the very end. Now, there are lots of markup, macros almost within LaTeX. And there's the basic set that just comes with LaTeX. But then there's a bunch of other ones. I mean, and Slackware apparently has quite a lot installed already, but there are yet more. And if you go to slackbuilds.org or you use SBO Find from SBO Tools, as covered in the previous episode, you can do a SBO Find on text. And specifically, you'll find a textlive-extras package, which gives you a bunch more things to throw into your writing. So if you're thinking that you need, I don't know, something that you that doesn't seem to be available within LaTeX, there's quite possibly some kind of extra plugin or macro, I don't know what they call them in LaTeX world, that will give you the sort of the auto, you know, the quick version of what you want. So for instance, I mean, this is just basic LaTeX as far as I know, but let's say we wanted to do a list. So it could be /begin curly brace enumerate close curly brace /item, and it could be hello, and then next line /item world, and then next line /end curly brace enumerate. I'm gonna press Alt 1 to auto or to quick build, and there we go. There's a nice attractive looking list. Hello world again, hello, one, hello, two, world. This is my third paragraph. This is a Kate part editor, clat 2. So there you go. That's a kind of a simple and quick list. Now, if you didn't want it to be enumerated, you just wanted it to be listed, you could do that. You can do /begin itemize instead of enumerate. And then I'll have to close itemize as well. Alt 1 to quick build, and now I've got bullet points instead of numbers. So it's just little things like that that produce relatively quick results. You've also got heading information. So for instance, if you do a /section, then you get a nice sort of a section title, a big sort of H1, I guess, probably sized title in your document. You can also implement subsections. So if you want to, you want to have a section, but then later on you want to continue, you want to sort of drill further down into that, it's literally /subsection, and then the title of that subsection. I'll just put next section in there. There we go. And Alt 1. And now I've got 1.hello world, and then a bunch of hello worlds. And then 1.1, next section. This is a K-part editor. So it makes sense. I wouldn't by any means say that it was intuitive. For instance, why do I have to close an itemized or enumerated list or section, but not a section or a subsection? Well, I guess the answer probably is that when you're starting itemize, it's the /begin itemize. The word begin, that's the instruction, begin. But when you make a section, you're just making a section. But then I guess the other question is, well, why is section an instruction and not an argument to the /begin instruction? And I don't know all of these things, you know, I mean, presumably there are different data types that it sort of expects and understands, and this is tapping into that or defining that, and that's okay. Like, so it's not necessarily, yeah, you're not gonna stumble into it and just kind of like get the feel for it. Okay, /, and then whatever I want, got it. You know, that's not like that. However, the advantage of Kyle, one of the many advantages of Kyle, is that it has menus, including one labeled LaTeX. And if you go into LaTeX, the LaTeX menu in Kyle, there's a bunch of tags there waiting for you, waiting to be discovered by you. So for instance, there's a preamble, which lists document class selection as an option, package import, AMS packages, start document body, author definition, and so on. And then you go down and there's tables and lists. There's all the different tables that you could create. There's an index, there's a print index, there's a glossary and a bibliography. Sectioning, there's a part, chapter, section, subsection, subsection, paragraph, subparagraph, references, environment, list environment, tabular environment, floating environment, math commands, and on and on and on. So, oh, font styles, that's important, like, you know, italics and things like that. That's kind of, and you can click on it and it inserts the instruction for you. For instance, in for italics, apparently it's / text IT and then some phrase that you know the argument for that is the word that you want to be in italics. So I guess I'll put this is a phrase in italics, and now I'll hit Alt 1 to render that, and yep, there it is. This is a phrase in italics right there under my section. So it you know the Kyle is not maybe the most graphical application you'll ever run across, at least not as far as I can tell. Maybe there's a toolbar that I have hidden or something like that. But it's not going to fool you into thinking that it's an office suite. It doesn't have a bar at the top with a bunch of buttons like bold and italics and, you know, like LibreOffice would, but it does have that menu and you can read through it and find the things that you want. And then, you know, the interesting thing about writing, honestly, is that after a while, you realize just how simple a process it really is. I mean, not if you're not a writer and you struggle to write, I'm saying, but in terms of the requirements for writing, there's just not that much. I mean, a text editor and a little bit of markup. And I do mean a little bit. 90% of your work is or your styling is done with really just the basics. And very frequently, less is more. And that's kind of why it persists, that writing a document is still a pretty, I mean, it's a basic process. And yeah, there are things that you need, like tables. Sometimes you really want a table, although I suggest you avoid tables, honestly. I think they're horrible. Horrible inventions. Terrible things to have to lay out. Okay, they're not horrible inventions. They're actually very useful, but they are bad for layout and very difficult to translate across different media. So I highly recommend translating tables to lists when possible, when it's practical to do so. So anyway, you don't need that much in writing, really. It's surprising. You just need a couple of fonts, maybe, like a serif or a not serif. You need maybe a bold or an italics to emphasize a couple of words here and there. And that's kind of it. You know, like headings, you need headings. Lists, those are important sometimes. I mean, I think they can be overused as well, but not all the time. Sometimes they're great. And then you just do the thing. So there's not that much to learn is what I'm implying. Like you can actually generate a fair amount of LaTeX and export it and get a really good result without learning that much LaTeX. Speaking of exporting it and getting results and stuff, at some point you do want to export this thing into some format. And there's lots of different formats. You can do PDF LaTeX, which generates a PDF. You can do BibTeX, which I don't really know what that is. It's got something to do with bibliography, I guess. LaTeX, I thought I was writing in LaTeX, don't know what that means. LaTeX to web, LilyPond, that's musical markup. Lua LaTeX, don't know what that is, but it has the word Lua in it, so it must be good. TeX, and so on. PDF TeX. So yeah, you've got a couple of different, and this is why I say I don't really exactly know. Like, I don't feel like I understand or am comfortable at all with the exporting options of LaTeX. And I don't think DocBook would necessarily be any better for a newcomer. That's pretty mystifying as well. It just so happened that when I learned DocBook, I also learned XSLT proc and how to chain it together through a makefile with a bunch of other stuff like FOP or just exporting to something nice like HTML or plain text, whatever. So yeah, I mean, and that I do feel is a little bit of a missing component here. It within maybe Kyle, or maybe not. Maybe it's not missing at all. But I couldn't figure out necessarily how to get everything sort of working correctly. So I selected for instance, LaTeX to web, but it says that it fails to start. And I don't know why that is. Is that because I need to do something myself to fix it? Or, I mean, it doesn't tell me why is that menu there if I don't have that installed? There's a view HTML button over here. I click it and nothing seems to be happening. So it's a little bit mystifying to me, and it's probably, you know, arguably because I don't know what I'm doing. I think that would probably be a really good reason, probably. Let's see. Oh, wait, here's the compile. Yeah, I think that's the same thing. Yeah, it just fails to start when I try to go out to HTML. So that makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, because if the only thing I can output to is PDF, that's not really going to work for me. But it certainly is a lot less scary now. And Kyle, I think, would be something that if I were going to write in LaTeX regularly, I would absolutely do that with Kyle. I would want to use Kyle, I think, because it's a really nice little application. It's doing exactly what you'd want a text editor to do. I mean, it's so nice, in fact, frankly, honestly, I kind of feel like I could live with a similar editor for DocBook. Like, that would be kind of neat. I could see that working for me. I mean, I'm sure there must be one. I just never thought to look. I mean, Emacs is my editor, and I'm pretty happy with it. But you do kind of wonder if there's something out there for, you know, that would give me a quick live preview of DocBook output. Who knows? That could be interesting. I don't know if I would actually use that feature, but I don't know. Auto completion, I mean, I'll take that anytime. So yeah, it is nice. Kyle is really nice. If you write in LaTeX and haven't tried Kyle, try it. From what I can tell, it's kind of a little bit similar to Text Studio. I mean, from a superficial level, I mean, never having used Text Studio and only barely having used Kyle, I would say they were very similar. So take that with many grains of salt. But Kyle is quite nice. I am very impressed with it. I think if I were seriously investing in LaTeX, Kyle would be something that I would be very excited about and I would want on all of my computers. And it's just a twist of fate that I found DocBook and not LaTeX, and I'm just comfortable enough with DocBook that I'm happy to continue using it. Maybe not forever, you never know. I mean, maybe I'll transition to LaTeX at some point. You never really know what the future is going to hold, but not anytime soon. So I'm not going to use Kyle. In fact, I am probably going to uninstall it now, but it was great to experience. It was very nice to try it out and to finally really experience LaTeX for myself and see that it wasn't quite as scary or mystifying as people seem to say that it is. And I don't know if people say, you know, I don't know if it's just an aversion to explicit markup that makes people say that LaTeX is, I don't know, confusing or scary or whatever. I do think there's a little bit of that. People just don't seem to really, I don't know, I think people associate markup with, I don't know, code. I guess that's what it is in a way. But people, I think, tend to think that it's rudimentary and laborious, whereas I think it's explicit and very clear, and I really, really appreciate it. So I don't know. I really enjoyed LaTeX. I would recommend it to a friend who was maybe looking for something a little bit more robust than Markdown, but maybe had an aversion to XML. I'd suggest LaTeX, absolutely, without hesitation. I was very impressed. So that's Kyle and LaTeX for the price of one. And now it's time for coffee. Okay, I've got coffee. This time I've got some coffee from the bulk store that I go to in the big city, about an hour from here. And I kind of stock up on it and I bring it back. I don't remember what it's called at all. It's some delicious blend. I think it's called Wave or something, maybe. Wave or like Vibe or, you know, something sort of vaguely blissful sounding and sort of nice. There were three different ones there. and they were all new. It was all new to me. It was not the usual blends, so coffee beans. So it was kind of exciting, and I'm gonna say that I'm not really sure if I've found the correct way to make it yet. I'll put it that way. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying I don't know that I'm noticing I'm drinking anything different than what I was drinking yesterday, which is kind of weird because usually when I change what I'm drinking, I notice. So I don't know. I'll give it some time, report back next week. Before I go on to the next application, let's look at some listener email. So one of them is from Dan again, and he says that for what it's worth, I'm reasonably certain that Keigo, not Kigo, not Kaigo, Keigo was meant to be read as K-ego, similar to K-K-A-Y, ego, E-G-O in English, based on the Japanese name, that's ego, I-G-O, transliterated, obviously, for the game of Go. So that's why it's called K-ego. Mystery solved. K-go would be fine for English speakers, but the game is from Japan. They call it ego there, apparently, and so K-ego makes a lot of sense. I didn't know that. I just thought Go was Go, so that was very useful. Thank you, Dan. Did he say anything else? Dan, calling it ego. This is interesting. Calling it ego can distinguish that game of Go from other games using the same Go board and stones, such as Gomoku no Rabe, like Pente, which I believe you discussed on an earlier episode, which I did. So, yeah, so that makes sense. It would almost be like having to differentiate between, you know, a chess board and a checkers board, I would think, or a drafts board. Is drafts the same thing as checkers? I don't even know. Honestly, I have no idea. That's K-Ego. I also got an email from Carl, who says that this feedback is a bit late, but I thought episode 462 about directory permissions was very helpful. I listened to it twice in the car and then again at the airport waiting for a flight, following along on my laptop. I liked the methodical approach. Permissions aren't really something I pay much attention to in my single user day-to-day use, but as soon as I'm in a situation involving multiple users and shared access, all of a sudden things quickly get interesting. And I'm reminded that whatever I thought I knew is either forgotten or was wrong all along. And I think there are a lot of subtleties. This is Klaatu again. I think there are a lot of subtleties to permissions that we breeze past. We forget about them. Or we don't understand it in the first place, and just everything's kind of working because the U-masks are set correctly on our system, and it just kind of falls into place. But things do get tricky, especially when you get multiple users, or even worse, multiple users and multiple computers, or sometimes just multiple computers, one user but across different systems. And I remember a time back when different Linux distributions or Unix distributions would start the system user out at different numbers, at a different number. So you had a bunch of distributions starting everyone out at like 1,000, and then a couple of others starting people at like 500. And so you'd get a computer, you'd install the OS, you'd create your user. It was user ID 500 on this system and user 1,000 on that one. But the names were the same, and you just wouldn't know. You couldn't figure out why the permissions are set correctly, apparently. And, you know, it got messy, I think. It gets messy. And so, yeah, trying to understand all that is sometimes, I mean, honestly, I think the methodical approach is the best way sometimes. Just really sit there, hack on it until you really understand all the different levels. And then you don't use it and you've forgotten. For instance, I have forgotten everything that I learned in 462. So I'll have to listen to that episode myself. Okay. And he also sends, so he sent an email, or an article rather, sorry, in this email to a very interesting article about WebAssembly, which I don't know how that's going to fit into anything I ever talk about on this show, but I mean, eventually it will. WebAssembly, if you haven't looked into WebAssembly, it's really, really interesting stuff. You should definitely at least look into it, find out what it's about. But anyway, there's also, he sends this article about Git versus Fossil, and there's this quote from this site. It's wanderinghorse.net/computing/fossil. He says, why Git, this isn't Carl, this isn't Klaatu, this is the author of this blog. Quote, why Git has become so widely used, I'll never quite understand. It's fussy, utterly misanthropic, difficult to administer, and is it literally allows users to rewrite the history of source-controlled files, including the ability to delete older versions of a source-controlled tree. That's not only philosophically wrong, but flat-out brain-dead. End quote. I obviously strongly disagree with this. I will agree that Git is fussy. Maybe. I mean, will I? I'm not even sure if I'll agree to that. Utterly misanthropic. I might agree with that because that's just well said. That's a beautiful phrase. Difficult to administer. Yeah, I'll agree with that, I guess. And it literally, okay, so it doesn't literally allow users to rewrite the history of source controlled. I mean, it does, but not if you don't allow it. Like, the ability to do something doesn't mean that it's automatically there for everyone. So that's, you know, it's true, but it's misleading to complain about that. Yes, it allows users to rewrite the history. Well, maybe that's what you need to do at some point. Like, why, I would be concerned if a tool that I was using didn't allow me to do the thing that I decided I wanted to do. So I quite appreciate that. It says, including the ability to delete older versions of a source-controlled tree. Well, absolutely. Once again, it's a tool that is serving me as a user. Why wouldn't I be able to delete information? I would hope that I would be able to do that. It's my data. And again, the way that it's written, it makes it feel like just any old user can do that or something. And I don't know if that was the implication of this statement, but I mean, that is kind of how it comes across, at least reading it, I guess, technically. Yes, out of context, maybe. But I don't know. What other context is there here? And that's not only philosophically wrong, but flat out brain dead. I strongly disagree with both of those statements. Philosophically wrong. It's not philosophically wrong. It's just a different philosophy of managing your own data. And brain dead? No, I don't think so. So, I mean, and I recognize that I'm strongly biased towards Git. I'm a big fan of Git. It has been my first and practically my only version control system. It's not strictly true. I've used Fossil as well, but on a quite a major project, actually. But this is a funny paragraph, nevertheless. It is well expressed, and I understand the frustration because Git can be frustrating. It really can be. But there's so much to understand about branching and forking and merging and all those other, and fast forwarding and all those things that you just never quite understand. And then when you start to understand it, or you think you start to understand it, insofar as at least the commands are working in a way that you sort of expect, then something gets updated and things are different. And that gets annoying. Or you start to understand it using the thing on your own, and then you're dropped into a situation where you're using it in, you know, actually with other people, and you're committing to a repository that other people are committing to, and suddenly everything's different, because now where it used to be you could fast forward whenever you wanted, now it's completely different. Or you submit to a repo and someone says, oh no, you got to squash your commits. So that's how we do it here, or something weird. You know, you're just like everything. There's so much customization that's possible, and so it can feel frustrating because you don't understand. You feel like you're starting to understand Git, but then someone tells you that you're doing it wrong, meaning maybe that you're not doing it wrong, but you're not interfacing with the Git repo correctly for the preference of that particular repo administrator. So it can be really, really tricky and frustrating, because when that happens, obviously it doesn't feel great. It feels like, you know, like you're not, like, it doesn't feel fair. You feels like you figured it out, and then someone's insisting that no, you had it wrong actually, and there's some other way that we do it, and that is upsetting. But I mean, the same kind of thing is going to happen with other systems too, to be fair. I can't believe that Subversion, that there wasn't frustration with Subversion. I can't believe that there's not frustration with Fossil every now and again. I mean, I know there is. I've used Fossil, and just getting over the differences between Git and Fossil can be confusing. Understanding when you need to open Fossil and what a commit really entails and all these other things, it can get kind of confusing. So funny, but maybe a little bit unfair, maybe. Either way, really well written, And it is one of those things where I think I'm not going to say that it's wrong, because I do think it's just a difference in preference. And I'm not even sure, I'm still not sold on my preference being the way Git does it. It's just literally that's what I'm used to. And that's where the mind share is. And so it just kind of pays right now to just keep using Git and keep getting better and better at Git, because that's literally what pays. Like it literally pays to know Git. So it's kind of the smart thing to do. And I don't say that sort of thing about technology usually, you know, I mean, really, I don't like to chase sort of like what's popular necessarily, or, you know, what'll get you the job necessarily, but in some cases, especially when it's open source, it sort of makes sense to do exactly that. Now, all of that said, again, Fossil is a really, really nice system. Like it, and it is one of those systems that, yeah, probably a lot more people should check out. Like it is really, really nice. Absolutely. It has innovations wrapped up in it that would just shock you. I mean, really, it's like every Fossil instance is its own GitHub or GitLab, or, you know, choose your host, Gitee, or whatever. Like, it's got a wiki, it's got a built-in wiki, it's got like a website, it's got a web view, and it's the repository, the source, the version control repository. It's amazing. You should absolutely check out Fossil if you haven't. I've done episodes on it in the past, I think. And heck, you know, I'm talking myself into using it again myself, actually, because I haven't used it recently, and now I feel like I'm cheating myself. So I don't know. Job done, apparently. Blog post. You have made me, and Carl, you've made me think about Fossil again, and think seriously that I need to put something into Fossil, because it is absolutely worth keeping on the side, at least. You know, like have a Fossil, have a repo in Fossil, because it is really, really nice. I mean, it's done by the guy who did SQLite 3, Dr. Richard Hipp. Like, there's no greater recommendation for using it. I mean, the guy is really, really clever, and Fossil definitely shows how clever he is. Okay, let's talk about Killbots, I guess. Killbots is, as you can imagine, a video game, but it's not, interestingly, about killing bots. It's about being killed by bots. Very, very different. Killbot. So the robots on the board, when it starts, you're a human, sort of dead center, and there are a bunch of robot icons scattered around the board. Now you get an arrow icon, an arrow controller, and you can click in any direction, and your little character moves, let's say, one square in that direction. The robots converge upon you based on where you move. Now they can only move one square at a time as well. Then again, there are like eight of them or six of them or something. So they do encroach upon you relatively quickly. And when one is right next to you, you cannot move laterally, well, or littorally away from them. You can move diagonally usually. So yeah, you can kind of move away, but if they're right next to you, if they're like sort of flanking you, then you cannot step away from them. And that's when you're probably going to get caught. Luckily, you're a very clever human and you have a teleport button. And so there's a teleport button in the top menu bar that you are able to use to try to get away, well, to get away from the robots. The cool thing is, though, you can trick the robots. They're not very smart. And if you trick them to collide with one another, then they explode. So the idea is that you're trying to get away from these robots in such a way that they can't capture you, that you don't run into them, and that they sort of, I say collide, and it's not exactly, well, yeah, I guess it is a collision. If they move onto a space that has a destroyed robot on it, or two robots try to occupy the same space, then they do collide. You, like I say, you can, when they get destroyed, their sort of trash piles stay on the board. So if anything runs into those trash piles, they break. It's a really fun game, and it's one of those things that at first you think, well, this will be easy. And then you see all those robots move one step towards you. And you think, okay, there's no way I can do this. But then they start crashing into each other. And you think, okay, this could work. This could happen. And it's a puzzle. It's a real puzzler. I've never seen anything like it before. I don't know if it's some, you know, I don't know if this is like a classic game that everyone knows about or what, but I found it very, very enjoyable. I was really, really surprised. And it's just, there's kind of a simplicity to it and a real puzzle to it. A lot of fun. So if you haven't played Killbots, try it out. It is worth it. It's a good one. It's a surprisingly good one. Killbot. And then last but not least is K-Image Format. It is a plugin for Qt GUI to help KDE, and I guess Qt by extension, load a variety of image formats. That's it. That's K-Image Format. Not a whole lot to say about it. Qt is an amazing framework. What can I say? It really is. And the KDE frameworks just makes it that much better. It's just such a rich ecosystem. It really makes you want to get into C++ programming just to experience Qt. I mean, it's just that good. And, you know, we all should, really, if we want to. But I'm not going to do that right now. Right now, I'm going to end this episode and continue my coffee. Thanks very much for listening. I'll talk to you next time.